welcome to another episode of the First Incision, a CMF podcast, where we look at topics at the interface of faith and medicine that affect our Christian lives in today's world. I'm your host, Dr. James Howitt, and I've got with me today Dr. John Greenall. John, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure. Great to be here.
So John is the National Fields Director with us at CMF, and he's going to be talking today on the issues of transgender in children. Thank you so much for coming to be with us today. Tell us, first of all, what is it exactly that you do, and why is this transgender in children an issue that you're sort of so concerned about?
Yeah, sure. I'm a paediatric specialty doctor north of London. I've worked in peds for just over 10 years. And as you've said, I also work with CMF as National Field Director. And I'm passionate about working with children, particularly children from traumatised backgrounds. So I do some work in the community with looked after children particularly, but also work acutely on the wards as well. Yeah, I guess I'm concerned. I think many others are at the trends that we're seeing in society at the moment. As medics, we're seeing that play out on the clinics and the wards in front of us. I'm just thinking of an example recently. A young girl was admitted to our ward with self-harm and suicidal ideation, and she said that she wanted to use a male name and male pronouns. And she was a young girl who was had a very, very difficult background, a very disrupted background, multiple placements, diagnosis of depression, anxiety, and now saying that she wanted to be treated as a boy. And the reaction was quite interesting. I mean, and I don't blame our staff, but you know, there was a lot of tiptoeing around. We were told multiple times that we needed to use the pronouns he and his, and that he could get upset if this didn't happen. And we've seen this over the last, just over the last two or three years, I've seen this happening more and more on the wards. It's very new. And gender dysphoria, used to be called gender identity disorder, has always existed in children. But we're seeing this almost contagion-like appearance of multiple children, particularly those who are a female wanting to identify as man. It's so stark and so sudden that I think that I'm concerned that we're rushing headlong into an area that's quite untested and uncertain scientifically, but also as a Christian, there are some issues that I have with it as well.
So give us a feel of the scale for the transgender issue in the UK within kind of children and teenagers.
Yeah, sure, James. I mean, I think let's be clear about definitions. So we're not talking about disorders of sexual development, which used to be called intersex. We're not talking about that. That's where we see about 1 in 5,000 births, and I've seen a number of them where there's a recognised what we call deviation in development of the biological sex organs, and there are decisions to be made there. But transgender is much more about where biological sex is not in doubt, but instead the person may feel emotionally and psychologically that they were born perhaps in the wrong body,
right,
if you like. So as you asked for numbers, I think, interestingly, just last year, a study in paediatrics, a big American journal, found that young people are, get this, 329% more likely than adults to identify as transgender. Wow. So hugely more than adults. There are almost as many transgender teens as there are adult men and women who identify as gay and lesbian. So a different category, but that just shows you the number. That's about 0.7% in children and young people. I mean, in the UK, there's been a 300% increase in the number of referrals to the tertiary Tavistock clinic just in the last 3 years.
Wow.
I mean, you're talking about hugely steep rises. And the Tavistock is still the only centre that deals with this for children in the UK. It has satellite clinics in Exeter and Leeds. And I think, very interestingly, more and more girls are being referred. So just 9 years ago, 41% of adolescents referred to the Tavistock were female. But in 2017, there were 69% were female. So a big spike in children. And I think linked to this is we need to be very clear that very sadly, many children and adolescents who present as transgender often have troubled backgrounds and often multiple mental health diagnoses. And I for one, and I know many of my colleagues, are yet to meet a child who presents as with gender dysphoria, that's the distress associated with it, mm-hmm, who hasn't had a significant disruption to their background. Nice. And in fact, that's backed up by research. So a big study in the States, again in paediatrics, looked at 120,000 adolescents aged between 11 and 19 and found some really troubling things. So they found that 51% of female to male transgender young people had attempted suicide. that number is about 30% of male to female. And compare that to the rates in non-transgender teens, where that rate is around 18% of females in that population and 10% of males. So we're dealing with, I mean, these are all figures, and it's easy to talk about figures, but we're dealing with real people, real young people who are often significantly troubled. And I think we need to acknowledge that, and we need to acknowledge the burden of bullying and social isolation. We've all been there in the school playground. I was bullied for different reasons when I was younger, and it can be brutal if you don't fit in. And so if we're talking about these things and young people who have felt on the edge and isolated, if they feel that they're being included and that they're, you know, happier because of that, then that's a good thing. But as we talk and as I find out more, this is far more than that, though. This is about where gender's very definition, there's an attempt to actually change its definition so that it's something that our children choose. No, not even just can choose, but must choose for themselves. And I think we're seeing the number of children who are confused about their gender identity soaring. And that, at the very least, that's interesting. And I feel it's also quite troubling.
So obviously we'll talk about choice, I think, in a few minutes' time. But first of all, obviously you've said this is about real people. So let's talk about real people. A child presents as transgender. Walk us through what might happen to them, what they might see, and what the process is going to be that they might go through.
Sure. And as you say, every child is unique, and it's hard to say for everybody, but I think certainly there's four main stages that we recognise. So the first is social transitioning. That can often happen from a very young age, and by the time that most children will see you as a medic in clinic, or at least certainly go to a tertiary centre, they will have been socially transitioning for some time. That's the dress, the pronouns that they use, and their identity, if you like, perhaps on social media as well. So after social transitioning, there is what we call puberty blockers. So these are for children who are defined as having persistent gender dysphoria as they're approaching puberty. It's quite a widespread practice. There were 800 of these practices in the UK last year, is to prescribe them what we call puberty blockers. And these are gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonists. And the argument given for that as a positive is that, look, this delays puberty. It means that these children aren't having distressing secondary sexual characteristics that might be very uncomfortable. It's a body that they don't feel comfortable in. But also that it buys them time to make decisions and figure out what to do. The reality is that nearly every single one of those 800 who are on puberty blockers will then progress to cross-sex hormone treatment, which is the third step. And in the UK, the NHS doesn't license treatment for under 16s.
Right, okay.
Although in private clinics, you are allowed to treat children and children as young as 12, where we think are being treated with sex hormones.
Gosh.
And then the next step after that, as with adults, is surgery. So it's a four-stage process, really.
So obviously, when we're talking about children, and you've said even children as young as 12 in some cases are being given some of these hormonal treatments, consent and capacity is obviously going to be an issue for us as medics, and particularly around children who I've been told some children put incredible pressure on parents and professionals by saying, look, I'm so distressed by this. If I'm not able to transition, I'm going to take my own life. How do we respond to that, and how is that kind of pressure and that consent managed between parents, professionals and the child?
Yeah, as always in paediatrics, it's a real balance. Look, we want to listen to children. As a paediatrician, the first thing I want to do is respect and listen to children and hear them and make sure that their voices are heard in a world where often it's adult voices that are heard. So we take that very seriously. And obviously we go on a case-by-case basis. I think certainly my concern around this is more just a general groundswell that actually there's a lot of societal pressure that's coming on medics to accept at face value what a child is saying. So in the States, it's what they call a very, in inverted commas, affirming care process. So, you know, a child presents, they say they're gender dysphoric. Your response as a medic should be, okay, let's talk and let's accept you for who you are and help you in that. So with very little counselling, very little kind of challenge, perhaps children you know, will go down that route. And some people feel that affirming care becomes almost a professional imperative. You know, don't question who these children are, let them tell you who they are, and then accept their identity in a nurturing and encouraging manner, which sounds very kind and very gentle and wonderful, but The problem is the stats, they just don't back it up. The medicine doesn't back it up. And as medics, we're being asked to give treatment in areas that I think many of us are very uncomfortable in, but the pressure is there from the climate. Now, the suicide, you mentioned that suicide thing, which is very sad. But the reality is that over 90% of children who present as transgender actually will then live in their birth sex if they're untreated. Okay. So they will go on to live in their birth sex. And I've looked at all these studies. There's only 11 of them going back to 1972. And I mean, they're overwhelming, really, that actually they do often go back to their birth sex. And actually, suicide rates are not higher.
Okay.
And we must resist this pressure, to feel pressured to treat, when actually the evidence of the efficacy of these treatments in the long run is still very untested. So let's be ready to gently push back on that. The evidence doesn't support better outcomes, and we shouldn't be practicing medicine with a metaphorical gun pointing at our head.
So you've obviously given us some statistics, and we can see this is a massively growing area. What is driving this increase in referrals and the number of kids that are identifying as transgender? It's been talked about. I know that some people say it's a mental health crisis and it's linked to social media. Others say it's because it's more acceptable and more socially kind of understood and accepted. Is there a definitive answer as to which one it is?
Yeah, good question. I think the overall answer is we don't really know yet.
Okay.
The question is really, are adolescents who are generally unhappy with life anyway more likely to present as transgender?
Right.
Or is their misery a result of societal attitudes and that it was always there as a latent thing anyway? And I think that, you know, a small number of children, as has always been the case, have persistent and I think genuine gender dysphoria. Okay, there's no doubt about that. The numbers are very tiny, but that is true. But I think it's likely that many young people who are in difficult and complex family situations are seeking attention and affirmation. I mean, just looking on the ward, just looking at the response of adults to children who say, "Hey, I'm transgender," it gets people hopping around and dancing around and being very careful around them. It grabs a lot of attention, and I'm not blaming the kids for that, but I think that's certainly an issue. I mean, interestingly, there's this study published in PLOS One in 2018, surveyed thousands of teens who presented with this rapid onset gender dysphoria in adolescence. And they found that the majority of those had pre-identified mental or developmental issues that had been diagnosed. And I think, as I said earlier, that's my experience on the wards. I think it's the experience of everyone I speak to who see children like this. So I think the mental health thing is certainly...
There's definitely something to that.
Definitely something to that, yeah. Okay. I mean, you mentioned acceptability. Is it because it's coming more acceptable? Well, yeah, I think, of course, it's been promoted and normalised by the media. I think the end of 2018, the BBC said that it plans to further promote LGBT culture on screen. Apparently, this is to avoid a heteronormative culture, and therefore people's LGBT identities will be shown more often, regardless of their relevance to the storyline or the news item. And so I think that it is more acceptable, and what might have previously been a normal part of childhood to briefly explore, you know, what does it mean to be a boy, or, you know, to be a girl, for example, that it's been potentially jumped on a little bit, and it's about saying, well, you know, no, you need to explore this, and this is something for you to define. And we celebrate, don't we? We celebrate those who come out as the real me. If they come out as transgender, the big celebration, affirmation, to go the other way and say, well, actually, no, I am going to live in my birth sex. I think many adults and children will also say they're not celebrated in quite the same way. So I think we just have to realise that, you know, the popularity and focus on children who have perhaps previously felt isolated or who are in difficult situations, they're going to get more attention, which of course you would. That's the really difficult situation to be in as a child. You're searching for who you are, and you're looking for people to a community to belong to and to be celebrated for that identity,
meaning as well, I suppose, to some degree.
Absolutely.
So obviously you've mentioned a little bit about social contagion and particularly rapid onset gender dysphoria. Could you unpack those a little bit? Can they be a trigger for the rising referrals as well?
Yeah, really interesting point. I mean, very interestingly, before 2012, there were very few cases and pretty much no research on adolescent females who develop gender dysphoria that first starts in adolescence. But parents have been reporting over the last few years that their children are kind of describing this rapid onset gender dysphoria, if you like. It appears for the first time during puberty or even after its completion. And it's Lisa Lippman and her colleagues did this study. And they found that there was this context of a peer group where one or maybe multiple friends have become gender dysphoric or identified as transgender, and they've done so during the same time frame, and that the parents report increased social media use. We know that particularly with girls, social media use has obviously grown since 2011, 2012 with the advent of the ubiquitous smartphone. And Lippman in her study talks about this cluster of outbreaks occurring in this groups of friends, and this, raising the possibility of social and peer contagion. And we just look at YouTube. We know there's many of these celebrities like Jazz Jennings who have millions of followers. So I think it's just something there for us, if we're parents, to think, well, what are our children looking at? Who are they following? These stories are very powerful. We know, of course, that we see similar trends with something like anorexia, with a number of adolescent girls usually in the same place at the same time with a definable set of social relationships identifying with certain eating disorders. And we see these pop up and from place to place, suicide contagion as well. So these social dimensions are difficult to map, but we're beginning to map them a lot better. And it's just that awareness that particularly with young, vulnerable and developing minds on social media, children very much more at risk of many mental health diagnoses using social media early on. But the fact that this ideology and personal narratives about transgender are out there, and that as we treat and counsel children, we should be aware of these things and have some understanding of what they're looking at.
So, John, you've laid out the topic fantastically for us, and that's really great. Thank you so much. I'm sure that the question on everyone's lips, and certainly on mine, is with all the stuff that you've laid before us, what on earth do we do about it? What should our responses as Christian medics be to this issue?
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's a really good question. I mean, I hope that those listening would join me in thinking that actually compassion for children is the first place we should start, because so many that we meet are feeling bullied and rejected and have had difficult lives. We need to be aware that there are some who are going to present with real gender dysphoria. We still don't know why. There's obviously generally a mixture of nature and nurture there, but it's a real thing in a small number, and we need compassion, and we need to treat them with thoughtfulness and respect. We need to get to know families, and of course, if you're a general practitioner, you'll know that long gone are the days you have this built up relationship with families over years where you can actually see them and understand them. And often you may see a child for the first time or the second time and be asked to refer them to a gender identity clinic. But I just encourage us to try and have those conversations, to encourage reflection, to actually give them the evidence in its broadest brushstrokes, with all the uncertainty that's there, and be there to support them. If a referral is actually necessary, to be there and support these children and these families. I hear people say, well, John, would you use preferred pronouns on the wards? And my answer to that is, again, I want to get to know the child. If I felt that it facilitated their care, that I needed to do that, I would. But as with my opening example, I've seen people hopping around and jumping around. And I think we've just got to be careful. We risk being complicit in a lie that the child says who they are. Is at that very moment something that we should unquestioningly and immediately affirm? I don't think that's healthy for our children as well. So compassion with balance. I think we also need to practice good medicine. As Christians, that's our prime duty, really, is to be practicing good medicine. And I think I've already laid out that there is not convincing evidence that these interventions are helpful. Children can't vote, they can't smoke, they can't drink, they can't leave school, but we are allowing them to make decisions about their fertility and sexual function in an increasingly unfettered way, and that makes me uncomfortable. And it makes me uncomfortable about prescribing puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones to children in my care. I think for cross-sex hormones that's not such an issue because there aren't these shared care agreements, but I think as a conscience issue we need to be thinking about that as well as Christians.
Okay. Fine. So finally, from a theological perspective, what does this debate tell us a bit about authority and identity and how we as Christians kind of view that versus the secular world?
I think this has very interesting reflections on what authority is. Where does authority come from? it's a boy, it's a girl. You know, we are, for so many years, we have imbibed this, I think, a scientific view of male and female, which lines up with a biblical view. That men and women are created as male and female with this external authority, that we're actually given our identities from outside of ourselves. But obviously in society, we're increasingly rejecting that. We're saying that there's the idea of authority coming from outside of us, especially a divine being, especially from the Bible. We're increasingly suspicious of that authority. And interestingly, I think medics and people in positions of authority in society are also being seen to be a potential threat to personal autonomy. And when you have unfettered personal autonomy and individualism, these things can be seen as a threat. And so our secular society locates authority in human beings and even in our children. And yes, we need to respect and listen to our children, but we also need to protect them from making harmful choices. So I believe that adults have a role in that. The government has a role in that. As medical professionals, as responsible medical professionals, we have a responsibility to help protect children. And I believe as a Christian that's a God-given authority that we need to handle, obviously, with great care. But when that authority is rejected, and ultimately it is a rejection of this God-given authority to both parents and government and so on, we run into problems because everyone can just do as he or she sees fit to run their lives. So when a boy insists that he's a girl, what do we do? Do we affirm his feelings or do we gently but also firmly remind him that he's created as a boy, that he's unique and perhaps feels different to many other boys, but actually he's no less of a boy? That plays into, I think, issues of us having overly tight, restrictive gender stereotypes, where we say, you know, oh, if you're a boy, you need to be a rugby player, or if you're a girl, you need to like ballet and like pink. And I think that's very unhelpful. Mm. And the message to a boy who perhaps presents more in a more feminine way or has interests that are more traditionally associated with females is to be able to say, look, you're no less male. I can affirm you as a boy, that God's made you as a boy, and you can be secure in that identity. And the great freedom, you see, I think, James, is that as Christians, we can say we're free in the identity that God has given us. There's no pressure to create an identity for ourselves, particularly as children, that we don't have to figure out who we are, but the Creator who made us, who loves us, who knows what's best for us, can tell us who we are. And I think that's wonderful. And so I think as Christian medics, it makes it tough for us in this society.
Absolutely.
Will we do good medicine? Will we really seek to treat the vulnerable from abuse and harm? The evidence does support the biblical worldview that God has made us male and female. There are, of course, some very small numbers where that is a struggle with true gender dysphoria. But we recognize there that the fall does affect us. The fall affects us socially, psychologically, physically, sexually. It does that to all of us in different ways. But I think that the issue here is about confusion, and that there's a confusion around one's basic identity as male or female. And that is the most fundamental confusion that can be sown, I believe, by the evil one. And if we allow this to go unchecked, it's no wonder, I think, that children and adults as well are confused about other areas of life. So I think that in this profession, let's not make an exception on this issue. Mm-hmm. As Christians and as medical practitioners, let's not look back in years to come and say that when our children most needed us to stand up for them, that we bottled it. That's my hope and my prayer.
Amazing, John. Thank you so much. Finally, is there anywhere that people listening can go if they're more interested in the topic, go for further information, anything like that? Any resources you can recommend?
Great. Yeah, I think there's some very helpful things. So I think online there's a helpful website called Transgender Trends, which just checks some of the facts and so on that we see. I think familiarise yourself with some of the stories of transgender young people on YouTube. I think it's helpful to walk a mile in their shoes. A number of good books from a Christian perspective as well. Transgender, a very short one by Vaughan Roberts. Andrew Walker has a book called God and the Transgender Debate, which I think is very helpful, particularly thinking of it as parents. Understanding Gender Dysphoria by Mark Yarhouse is another good treatment of the topic as well. So yeah, I'd recommend all of those as places to go.
Great. John, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for sharing and imparting to us. It's been fantastic. hope that you've all enjoyed that, and we look forward to hopefully being with you in a couple of weeks' time for another episode. Thanks, and God bless.